Jane Ann Morris, Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy. How Free Trade is Stealing Our Democracy. Jane Ann Morris was one of the principal members of the Program on Corporations, Law and Democracy, POCLAD.org. That was a think tank of about a dozen persons, co-founded by Ward Morehouse and Richard Grossman just before the Rio Earth Summit in 1992. Long before the 2010 Supreme Court decision in Citizens United ruled that corporations, as persons, are entitled by the U.S. Constitution to buy elections and run our government, Jane Ann Morris had written, spoken out, and campaigned on the decades-long efforts of U.S. corporations to use the Supreme Court to expand and solidify their power. She likens the U.S. Supreme Court to the infamous unelected panels that today in international trade are empowered to overrule the laws of entire countries, even the size of Canada and China, when they're putting restrictions on corporate trade or have the audacity to protect the environment and labor. Recorded 1 year before Citizens United, this interview reflects Jane Ann Morris' research of the previous decade, a summary of the power grab going back to the 1880s, where corporations were first declared persons under the Constitution. Jane Ann Morris was interviewed by Tom Lewiston on Network X in Seattle on January 10, 2009. Here is Tom.
Good evening and welcome to Network X. Tonight we're joined by Jane Ann Morris from the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. And Jane Ann, I would just like to start the program by asking, how have we come to the point where we are that corporations have the same civil rights or individual rights that human beings have?
Well, corporations have a lot of constitutional rights. They don't have exactly the same ones. There was a constitutional amendment passed in 1868 to protect the rights of freed slaves against oppression by state governments. And that was used by corporate lawyers in the 1880s to get the Supreme Court to say that corporations were persons under the Constitution. And they would have, for the purposes of the 14th Amendment, equal protection and due process rights. And that wasn't even argued at the time, although two eloquent dissents in the Supreme Court were written in the 20th century to that, Supreme Court justices who were really upset about it. It was established in the late 1880s, and it was used as an excuse to basically invalidate a number of state laws throughout the 1880s, the fact that corporations had the rights of equal protection and due process. And it became sort of a gateway right, so that after that we see dribbling in more and more parts of the Bill of Rights that have been granted as rights to corporations by judges.
What are some of those rights that corporations now have?
One of them is the Fourth Amendment right to protection against unreasonable searches and seizures. This was first recognized in the early 20th century, and in a really famous case in 1978, it was used to prevent OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, from doing an inspection of corporate facilities. So we have a corporation using Bill of Rights protections, in this case the Fourth Amendment, to protect itself from the state inspection. And this is in the context of a corporation being created and brought to life literally by a state, because all corporations only exist because they have charters granted to them by state governments.
And do those charters have time limits?
They used to have time limits. A charter used to also have a specific purpose, a specific time limit. If the corporation did anything outside that purpose, their charter was revoked. It was almost automatic in some cases, and for a long time, legislatures could do it without courts. But right now, if you look at the corporate law, what's essentially the charter of a corporation, there are no time limits, and it usually says it's granted in perpetuity. And this isn't something that's special out there, different from other laws. It's just a plain old law. Every state has a portion of its law that's about corporations called the corporate code. And these days, what it basically consists of is a list of powers that the state is granting to the corporation. But without that list in a corporate law, the corporation doesn't have any powers.
So the powers that the corporation does have could be legislatively changed.
Exactly. It's just a list of powers. It's not even like in the state constitution, although once in a while there are some aspects of the constitution that deal with corporations. For the most part, it's just in the law. And you're pointing to something interesting because those of us who've been activists have probably spent lots of time maybe reading labor law or reading environmental law or reading human rights law or reading about the insides of a nuclear power plant or reading about the dredging in the creek and some sort of pollutant. So we've dealt with a lot of minutiae, including legal minutiae. But when it comes to this area of law, which basically grants corporations huge powers, pieces of state sovereignty, I've met very few activists who've even ever looked at corporate law. And I myself didn't for a long time. I thought corporate law was something for corporate lawyers. I didn't want to go there, so I wasn't going to bother looking at it. But now I understand it's kind of like the missing core that we need to concern ourselves with, because whether or not we know what's in there, it affects us greatly.
And has there been any moves in states around the nation to change the corporate laws or corporate codes?
Oh, yes. As a matter of fact, every year or two, corporate lawyers write their latest amendments to the corporate law. They walk into the state legislatures, they toss it on a desk, and the state legislature passes it pretty much without any comment and certainly without any publicity. I know this isn't what you meant, but I'm making a separate point. They do this all the time. And as long as there are no activists or working people or whatever watching the corporate code, it's getting tighter and tighter and tighter, and that list of powers is getting longer and longer. That's starting to change. The people in Ohio who've been working with the program on corporations, law, and democracy did some research on the history of their own state laws, and they wrote a little booklet on it, the state laws having to do with corporations. And so they were aware of this. So when some corporation lawyers went in to make some minor changes, it was already pretty pro-corporate, to make some minor changes in the state law there, they were able to catch them at it and publicize it and actually begin a conversation in some newspaper editorial pages about these changes. Now, because so few people knew about it, they weren't able to stop it. But it's the beginning of an awareness of it that until recently we basically haven't had at all. I haven't had at all.
Back to the case that you cited, the 1978 case of OSHA. Mm-hmm. So the protections that were put in place to protect working people from on-the-job injuries, exposure to hazardous chemicals or materials, is not even enforceable.
Well, it's partially enforceable because what actually happened was the inspection was not allowed to be what you'd call an unannounced inspection. Okay, which of course is if you work at a workplace, that's the only kind that really makes any difference, that all kinds of things can be cleaned up in a day or two if you schedule an inspection. So it's not like there were no inspections at all. However, the Supreme Court did determine that the Fourth Amendment protection against unreasonable searches and seizures, which doesn't always work so well for us human persons, applied to corporate persons and would prevent OSHA from making the kind of inspection they felt they had to make. They had some reports of bad conditions at the plant. So it gets back to the decisions in the 1880s about equal protection and due process, which it's not entirely clear what effect that would have, what it means to say that a corporation now has equal protection rights. But I can give you an example of it. What that means is if a corporation has equal protection rights, you cannot discriminate against the corporation. Okay? To show you how absurd this can get, a few years ago, a local government in Massachusetts passed some ordinances about the location of cell towers. A major telecommunications corporation did not like them. So that telecommunications corporation used a combination of the 14th Amendment, equal protection rights, and the 1964 civil rights law to sue the local municipality and ask damages because the civil rights of the corporation had been violated. Now, you probably haven't heard this a lot before.
No.
That's what we're thinking, because once you start looking into the background on how corporate law changed and how important a part of that constitutional rights were corporations, where you start seeing all kinds of bizarre things like that. And what the program on corporations, law, and democracy is trying to do is let people know about this so this can be part of the conversations we have when we talk what should we do strategically. You know, if we know that these sorts of obstacles are out there, we know that sooner or later we're going to have to confront the fact that there's something really wrong with the idea that a corporation has constitutional rights. Because there are a lot of specific examples like this.
Can you just cite the case in 1886 where the decision was made in the Supreme Court?
The case is known as the Santa Clara case. The Santa Clara County in California had some tax issues with, I forget, one of the big railroads at the time, but it's known as the Santa Clara case, 1886. Well, it was actually a series of cases. That was the beginning of it. But between then and 1889, there was a series of cases where the Supreme Court said very overtly that both the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, that's this discrimination thing, and the Due Process Clause applied to corporations. So then after that, throughout the 1890s and for a couple strong decades after that, it was used pretty frequently in getting rid of laws. I'll give you another example. During the 1930s, there were what has been known as the chain store wars, when people were fighting chain stores the way that now they're fighting Walmart and other big box stores. The issues were similar. People understood that their local economies would be destroyed and so on. So states and municipalities came up with all kinds of ways of writing laws that would essentially make sure that their local businesses survived and that these large chain stores coming in from outside would be disadvantaged in some way or another. They were very overt about it. They were protecting their local economy. And many of these laws went to the Supreme Court and were declared unconstitutional because they discriminated against a certain class of corporations, which is, of course, exactly what we would like to do in many cases. I want to discriminate. I can name several classes of corporations I think a sovereign people, a self-governing people, should discriminate against. Ones that don't pay fair wages, ones that have human rights violations, ones that pollute, and on and on and on.
But we're not able to do that because of the powers that the corporations now possess.
We'll never be able to do that if no one questions it. You know, this was a decision, a series of decisions that Justice Hugo Black in 1938 and Justice William Douglas in 1949 wrote eloquent, moving dissents on, saying how absurd it was that an amendment passed to protect blacks against oppressive government was now being used to protect corporations against the sovereign people. And there was a law school dean in 1937 who proposed a constitutional amendment saying, look, the 14th Amendment is about human persons. So these were fairly mainstream people, fairly well-respected people. It was controversial for a long time. I guess we've sort of forgotten it because one of the main things that's happened is that we've sort of slid off into other arenas for activism. And one of them is regulatory agencies, which, if you spend a lot of time in them, they will strike you as profoundly anti-democratic. And if you look at their history and how they're structured, I think it's fair to say that they were undemocratic from the get-go. Think of all the time that people now spend on regulatory agencies of all kinds, and we could name a slew of them now, as opposed to asking more fundamental questions like, why does this corporation have constitutional rights?
Yep, one that I often criticize is the National Labor Relations Board. I mean, it's a barrier that has been established, I think, to convince labor organizers and the institution of labor that there is an administrative level where you can seek relief for a corporation to be made to toe the mark, but that seldom, if ever, happens.
I understand that. The pamphlet of ours over there was written by one of our members, Peter Kelman, and it's exactly about those issues. It's about how some of the laws supposedly put in place to help labor, in fact, retarded its growth and made it more difficult for organizing, and that's one of the examples that he gives there. You can make a more general statement about other things regulatory agencies do there. They tend to, for example, concentrate the three branches of government in one place because they essentially can make law, they essentially can judge the law, and then they can essentially punish or enforce the law. So already something is very wrong if you're calling something a regulatory agency, just technical, ma'am, and they combine the powers of the three branches of government. And when you add to that the fact that the costs in resources and money in pursuing a case to the end essentially makes it impossible for all but the best heeled or the biggest corporations to actually continue that. And, you know, there are numerous other things that are profoundly anti-democratic about regulatory agencies. And we started talking about this because a lot of our attention has been directed toward those agencies instead of questioning more fundamental things.
The underlying foundation. Can you talk for a bit about how the individual rights that have been granted to corporations plays into free trade, NAFTA, or the Free Trade Agreement for the Americas?
Okay, well, this gets to the core issue of democracy here. First of all, I want to start out by saying that phrases like free trade and, you know, free commerce and so on is basically a red herring, because it's not about trade, it's about power, it's about control on the bad side, and on the side we would like to look at, it's about democracy, it's about who runs the show. Okay, so we can call it trade, but it's really about who's running it. What's happening now with the worldwide free trade agreements, put that in quotes, and I'll include WTO and NAFTA and the free trade area of the Americas, and there are slight differences among them that are important here. But what's happening in those cases is that an unelected trade panel of some sort, or arbitration panel, basically trade experts and trade lawyers, can decide if a national law, if a country's law, violates free trade. And if it does, it can put that country in the position of either changing the law or paying a fine or some sort of penalty or some sort of retaliation for keeping that law. And that's happened on any number of issues, on hazardous waste issues, on the hormone beef that the European Union doesn't want imported. It's happened on the hazardous waste case in Mexico. It's happened on import of water from British Columbia to the United States. And so it's really about an unelected authority with no legitimacy, as far as I can see in a democratic setting, making decisions about what national laws are valid. Now, the reason I set that up in that way is that we have the same thing going on in this country, only, again, it's been going on so long we don't think of it in that way, because there are all kinds of state laws in this country about truck safety on highways, about the import of beef or inspection of meat, about protecting natural resources, about protecting health and safety of citizens. Many, many state laws that states pass to protect their citizens in the United States that have been declared unconstitutional under the same idea. It's not called free trade, it's called the Commerce Clause, by our own personal unelected trade arbitration panel, which is the U.S. Supreme Court. By the 1930s, hundreds of state laws had been declared unconstitutional. And more was thrown into this area of free trade, and what you essentially have is a situation where five members of the Supreme Court can declare just about any law in the United States unconstitutional. And they've done much of it on this trade grounds, which they call commerce. So the arguments are the same. Some of the materials are the same. It's almost identical. We already live in a free trade zone in this country, is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. And it goes along with other constitutional rights of corporations as one of the obstacles to us being able to use the democratic process to take care of some things that really need to be taken care of now.
Listening to you and thinking about the idea of the whole notion about equal protection in the 14th Amendment, it seems that it's very one-sided when it comes to an individual's relationship with a corporation, either as a consumer or an employee, that the individual doesn't have the same equal protection or the constitutional protections once they're inside the workplace.
Exactly. If the workplace is a corporate facility or a corporation, the worker basically parks his or her rights at the door when he or she enters. At the same time, while the corporation, this, which is an imaginary thing, you know, whatever the corporation is, which is not exactly the same as the management or the workers or the physical plant, the corporation itself has constitutional rights, including free speech rights. So you can force workers to sit in on, be captives and be preached at and told all kinds of things which probably aren't true by management, because the corporation has free speech rights. Whereas most of the workers' ability to communicate, to organize while they're on that work site are gone. So it's a special case for workers if they're on corporate property. But I think you can argue that the rest of us don't really appreciate or aren't allowed really to use as much of our equal protection rights as corporations are, because it takes money to play. It takes money to participate, whether it's in judicial proceedings or other grievance kinds of things or regulatory proceedings, and the people with the most money last the longest. And most people who have a real problem with it but just can't, like, stop working or stop having an income for months or years until something gets resolved are sort of left out of that.
So the people that do the corporation's bidding have a long range have had a long-range strategy to shift the balance of power away from individuals and toward corporations. So that while individuals come and go, the long-term strategy by the corporate powers has been to gradually change the laws and convey those protections, more and more of those protections, to corporations.
Well, I assume so. I don't know if we'll ever find the diary, the Dear Diary version of what corporate executives were thinking, but I've done sort of the reverse of that by starting now and looking back and seeing how corporate law has changed since this country was founded. And it's really amazing. It's like piece by piece, the list of powers in the corporate code grows every few years. They get another flush of it and, you know, there's another list of powers. The list of responsibilities shrinks. The ability to escape liability and indemnify directors and top management so you can't ever sue them for anything. And if you can, if you are able to sue them, to some extent they have insurance to cover for that, which somehow the corporation always pays for. So yes, over time the list of powers has grown, the list of responsibilities has shrunk, and meanwhile you have mostly federal judges and federal Supreme Court justices granting one after another increased constitutional rights to this legal fiction of the corporation. That sounded really abstract, but I want to say something else, which is that everyone has in mind all kinds of terrible things that corporations have done, whether it's a matter of worker safety or dumping stuff in the river and on and on and on. But many of the harms that corporations do are perfectly legal. And that's one of the things that POCLAD is aiming at. Not just the fact, of course, that pollution is bad over there and those horrible things, but much of what they do that's horrible, that's destroying our democracy and people's lives and so on, is legal. And it's made legal by regulatory system, by the granting of constitutional rights to corporations, and by that list of powers in the corporate code. So it's not like we're just saying we need to enforce the law. That would be a good start in many areas, I agree. But that's far from the whole problem. We have to look at the underpinnings of the law, and it has to be something that's talked about in coffee shops and at bus stops, you know, and not just in corporate boardrooms or one or two activist groups here and there.
Are there chapters of POCLAD set up around the country, or is POCLAD acting as a resource base for activists?
Probably more like the second. We got to be about a dozen people from all over the country and one from the United Kingdom. Some of us work in groups full-time and are bringing POCLAD ideas to apply to the issues those groups are working on. Some of us, like me, are full-time working on POCLAD things, writing up position papers or articles on items of interest or in the news so that we can share that with groups that are working on those issues and maybe provide some ideas or different perspectives on things they could do. So I guess we're more sort of a resource group and urging groups working on whatever their issues are, and they know those issues best, to consider incorporating some of these aspects which we think will make their activism more effective. Corporations are created by a state, and they used to be told exactly what to do, how much real estate they could own, how long they could exist, 10, 20 years. If they did anything outside that, their charters were revoked, and it was fairly straightforward. So the idea was that since a corporation is created by a state, it's almost like a little piece of the government. And there's no question that the government, we the people acting through a legislature, would tell them what they can and can't do. So if any of those generalizations still held, and they held for quite a while, you wouldn't have a small group of corporate management making the decision what the corporation was for, where it was going to have its factories, and so on. The state that created it could make those decisions. So we would be in a very different situation now. And I think that Michigan used to have some laws requiring certain notice about plants leaving and other sorts of features that would ease the transition. And I believe they were taken to court and they were declared unconstitutional at the behest of corporate lawyers.
So there's a lot of what you're saying is there's a lot of deconstruction to do.
Exactly. Exactly. We need to not just worry about harms that we see, but try to understand how aspects of the law that are right now invisible to us, though they're all around us, are affecting us. The Commerce Clause I gave you was one example. We really do live in a free trade zone in this country. Another example is the way that corporations can claim they're being discriminated against and use civil rights laws and the 14th Amendment to protect themselves. But I don't want this to sound like it's really a legalistic sort of strategy, because frankly, none of that makes any sense if everyone on the street doesn't understand that corporations have constitutional rights. This has got to become something that's, you know, like I said before, talked about in the laundromats, the way that separate but equal was once before it was overturned. People have to be aware of this and talk about it, and then it will find its way into various activist groups.
With about 30 seconds left, I'd certainly like you to mention the book.
Oh, I didn't do that? Okay. This is the book. This is a result of probably 7 or 8 years of work by POCLAD. What it is a collection of articles addressing different issues as they came up, the role of regulatory agencies, the role of corporate social responsibility, labor, social security, and numerous issues just as they came up in the news, and suggesting what a POCLAD perspective on that might be and trying to raise some new possibilities for strategy.
Thank you, Jane Ann, and for Network X, this is Tom Lewiston saying goodnight, and please join us next Tuesday at the same time.
That was Jane Ann Morris, interviewed on Network X in Seattle on January 10, 2009. The book she mentioned is Defying Corporations, Defining Democracy. That's an anthology of 70 essays, speeches, sermons, and screeds written by POCLAD members. It came out in paperback in June 2001. A link to this interview on film is on my website at tucradio.org. Jane Ann Morris died on May 28, 2019, in Madison, Wisconsin. She was one of the primary researchers, writers, and workshop leaders in POCLAD, the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. Thanks to my friend and radio colleague Mike McCormick of Talking Stick TV and KODX LP Radio that air in Seattle. He sent me the link to this groundbreaking speech. Jane Ann Morris was about to complete a book on the role of the U.S. Supreme Court in dismantling democracy. We hope that someone will be able to put together her notes. Come back for another tribute to Jane Ann Morris when TUC Radio returns. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.